Welcome to the Power Hour. I'm Adrienne Herbert, wellness coach, international speaker, and author. Each week, I speak to a variety of guests, from business founders to Olympic athletes, leading coaches, change makers, and innovators, to find out their daily habits, their rules to live by, and what motivates them to get up out of bed each day. Personally, I am on a mission to encourage, motivate, and inspire, so I hope that the Power Hour will help you to achieve your personal and professional goals. Welcome back to the Power Hour podcast. Today, I am joined by Dr. Emma Svanberg, aka Mumologist, an award-winning clinical psychologist, speaker, and campaigner with expertise in attachment and perinatal psychology. Emma, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
Emma, there is so much that we could talk about. When I knew that I was going to be having this conversation with you today, my mind was overflowing with topics, discussions, questions, because I myself, I'm a mother and a stepmother. I love children. I love parenting. I love everything that goes with it. So the chaos, the fun, and what I call the colourful life that is parenting. So if I go to a big family party or when I was at a wedding last year, I'm usually the one who's gathering the kids together. I'm lining them up. Let's play a game. Let's play pretend. My friends always joke. They're like, yes, Adrienne's here. She is the one who can match the kids' energy and she can actually tire them out. So yeah, they're always pleased to see me at a wedding. They're like, yes, she's going to take care of the kids. But parenting, of course, also presents many challenges. So especially, I think, as you go through the different stages, so as your children get older, they're all so unique. They have different interests, different temperaments. They each respond to different things. And as parents, I think we play so many different roles. It's really, really complex. And of course, we have to consider our own childhoods and all of the things that have led us to becoming the people that we are. So complex, as I said, so much to talk about. So before we dive into all of my questions, I'd really love to start by hearing from you about your journey and the work that you do. So could you tell us, what led you into doing the work that you do today with parents?
Yes, I'd love to tell you about that, because there's quite a lot about my own childhood in that story. My father's also a clinical psychologist, and he got really interested in attachment and infant mental health when I was in my early teens. So I was really privileged, which I sort of didn't quite realise at the time, to hear lots of really interesting conversations between him and his colleagues. We had people who were, probably sort of celebrities in the attachment world come and stay with us. So I had lots of really interesting dinner table conversations, just at a time when you're in your teenage years where you're really soaking up information and thinking about the world and thinking about kind of how things operate and who you are. So that was how I became interested in attachment in the first place and psychology. I was very determined to not be a psychologist. So I actually started off doing an English degree. And then just as I went through my degree, I actually was getting more and more interested. I realised that so much of the things that I was interested in were all about human relationships. So I switched my degree. I then had a gap year, went to India, did some psychology work in a daycare centre, just to really make sure that that was what I wanted to do. And in the end, I've kind of really pulled together a few of my different interests in my work. So I work a lot around attachment and attachment trauma, but I also work with looking at gender equality in parental relationships and thinking about the sort of women's expectations or the expectations that have been placed on mothers. So I suppose in some ways my work is a kind of combination of my two big interests, which are really feminism and gender equality and attachment and trauma. So very small topics, but very complex,
fascinating,
as you said,
though,
in the beginning. And in many ways, the work that I do is a combination of all of those different things alongside lots of other interests too.
Wow. Yeah, it's fascinating. And also, I think all those intersections, it impacts so many different people. So the focus of this conversation, people might think, well, maybe if they're parents, then of course, this might start there. If they're not parents, then actually, all of those things that you said, relationships, attachment, gender roles, like all of these things, I think, impact all of us. So maybe we could start with attachment, actually. Could you explain to any of the listeners who perhaps haven't heard of attachment in the context of relationships, what that is all about?
I can. I think of attachment almost like a dance. I think it can seem really complex when we're thinking about patterns or how we interact, but actually it's almost like these steps that we learn in our very early relationships. And there are kind of four main kinds of attachment, although there's a lot of different theorists that are out there that talk about a much more complex idea of what attachment relationships are. The vast majority of people are securely attached. So around the world, that's over 60% of people are securely attached. And essentially what that means is that we are in a really lovely steady dance. So I think of it almost like a waltz. Everyone knows what their steps are. It's quite predictable. You know, there might be times where we trip over each other's feet sometimes, but we always have something quite steady and regular to come back to. The really important thing about attachment that often isn't spoken about, because we tend to think about our own attachment, how we are attached to people, but actually attachment itself is a relationship. It's about how we exist in our relationship with other people. So it's not just about how we are in our relationships, but also about what we expect from the other person in our relationship. So in a secure attachment, we would expect that somebody would be fairly consistently there for us, fairly available to us, emotionally connected some of the time, not all of the time. And we also have that understanding when we're securely attached that if somebody's not consistently there for us, then it's probably not our fault. You know, there might be something going on for them. And as we get older with secure attachment, if we're not receiving what we need from somebody that we're asking for it from, what we tend to do is we'll just go and find somebody else who's able to provide that for us. So as you can imagine, people who have that kind of steady waltz-like attachment dance tend to be pretty robust, secure, safe people who feel quite comfortable in themselves the majority of the time. Then you have what is called an avoidant attachment, which in my book, Parenting for Humans, I describe that as a little bit like an Irish dance where things look kind of quite still and straight on the surface, but underneath, kind of when you look below the waist, things are quite frantic sometimes and working very hard in order to keep that very straight appearance going. Avoidant attachment happens when we don't have a understanding that a caregiver will consistently respond to us. So we kind of have to learn to rely on ourselves. We learn to push our feelings down, to suppress them. But what research shows is that actually we might still be feeling lots of those feelings. We're just not showing them on the outside. The third dance is one that I think of as a very passionate dance. It's like an Argentine tango. It's one where sometimes people are very close together and they're very passionate and, you know, cheeks pressed to each other, and it can look very, very connected. But then the next moment, you know, you're on opposite sides of the dance floor and you don't quite know what's happened. What that would look like in a parenting relationship is something where sometimes if a child cries or asks for a need to be met, that need will be met. Sometimes it might be met with anger or frustration. At other times, it might not be met at all. So that child kind of grows up not quite knowing what to expect from their caregiver. But because they're not necessarily scared of their caregiver and they know that they can be consistently there at times, what they tend to do is escalate their requests. So that might be children who look like they've got challenging behaviour, who tantrum quite a lot, for example. But part of that is that they've learnt that actually, if I just shout really loudly, then I'm more likely that somebody's going to come and respond to me.
And what's that third one? Sorry, so secure, avoidant, and...
Well, it's quite interesting because it's got lots of different names, but anxious or ambivalent attachment is how that tends to be referred to. And ambivalence is quite an interesting word, right? Because it's that sort of slight ambivalence about, is this person going to be here or are they not? I don't quite know where I stand. And then generally speaking, we would talk about a fourth attachment. This is the one that gets really complicated, that has been called disorganized attachment. But one researcher, Patricia Crittenden, talked about that actually children who have disorganized attachment relationships are actually very, very organized because they adapt to what can be very chaotic environments. So that is usually what happens when you have a caregiver who's either frightened themselves, so perhaps there's lots of unresolved trauma in their life, or they can be quite frightening, so a scary parent or caregiver. And children will then, you know, adapt their steps. So sometimes it might look smooth, sometimes it might look really messy. occasionally people might fall over and it might look really chaotic. But what we know about disorganized attachment patterns are that actually in those kind of relationships, children are working very, very hard in order to be able to keep themselves feeling as safe and secure as they possibly can within those circumstances. So those are the kind of four main patterns or dances. What's really interesting about attachment is that we can see that as like steps that are quite regular that we learn in our lives, right? They're familiar dances that we get into. What's quite tricky is that then when we grow up, we might try and do those dances with other people too, and other people might not understand those dance steps. So either we can get into a bit of conflict about that, or what we often do is that we actually force people to do our dance with us because that's what feels familiar. And infamiliarity is what how we feel safe and comfortable, even if kind of in the longer term, actually it doesn't feel like a very comfortable dance for us. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. There's so much. Yeah, it's fascinating.
I mean, attachment is, you know, it's like, you know, it was first spoken about in the 1940s and we know so much about attachment since then. It's been kind of backed up in terms of global research. You know, there are these key sort of attachment concepts that are globally relevant. And we also now understand attachment in terms of brain development, in terms of different relationships. So in the past, we've tended to talk about attachment between a mother and a baby. Actually, really what we now know is that attachment forms in attachment networks. So we might have different kinds of relationship patterns or dances with other people in our lives too. So it's really complex. It's a very rich, fascinating area of research.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about as you were describing those. I was thinking about, of course, you know, reflecting on my own childhood and the relationships between my mother and father and myself. And actually, even those can be very different. So you could have, you know, one potentially right attachment style with one parent, and then maybe a different parent or caregiver gives you a different style. And I think that web is really interesting. And whenever I've read books about attachment, it's often been relating to romantic relationships. But I think it's very interesting for us to think about ourselves as parents, and it's always a tricky one, right? Because as parents, you're constantly, I think, challenging yourself to think, am I doing enough? Am I not doing enough? Am I pushing too much? Should I push more? Am I being enough of this or enough of that? And I think that's what, for so many parents, whatever age and stage your children are at, you love them, you want to do what's best for them, you want to also have, I suppose, an element of compassion for yourself in that you're a human being and that you're imperfect and that you're going to make mistakes, you're not going to be perfect. But it is, as you say, this fascinating web. And I think with that in mind, as a clinical psychologist with two decades of experience, what are, I suppose, some of the biggest changes that you've seen in that time and all that work that you've done? So 20 years ago, were parents facing the same, was it typically the same things as you're seeing today, or has it changed quite dramatically?
I love this question, because things have changed, to me, I think, quite dramatically. There are definitely these core challenges that parents have that they have always had, right? So even if we're thinking about attachment, you know, how do I reconcile the kind of experiences that I had growing up? What do I want to repeat for my children? What do I want to do differently? How do I resolve that with a partner who might have quite a different attitude to me? How do I parent in a community or in the world as it is now? Those are, you know, kind of concepts or questions or challenges that have been around for parents forever and ever. I think that the context in which we are parenting has changed so much. So when I first started working with parents, the really popular kind of parenting approaches were all very behavioural. Mm. So thinking about people like Gina Ford, you know, there's lots of things about reward charts or controlled crying. It was very much about parent-led parenting. And there was this kind of expectation that parents will do something and they're the ones who are kind of in charge, and a child will respond. And, you know, if it wasn't working that way, then you needed to look for behavioural rewards or punishments in order to be able to kind of train your baby or child to be this person that you wanted them to be. So quite outcomes focused in the 80s and 90s, very much around success, achievement, those sort of, you know, kind of goals that were much more around culturally at that time.
That's why we're all obsessed, hyper overachievers now, overachievers.
overachievers, that's our generation. Yeah. But you know, now I think what's really shifted is First of all, there's much more understanding of concepts like attachment. You know, these are concepts that have come out into our mainstream understanding, and also the impact on brain development, right? So we know now that there can be a kind of longer term impact on children who are anxiously attached, for example, or insecurely attached in any way. I will say that that is something that people can really panic about, but actually our brains are plastic and change forever. So all of these things are repairable, all of these things we can change. So I think sometimes people can feel that so much is at stake that they almost don't know where to go because, you know, they're so kind of set on getting it right, like you said at the beginning. I think in some ways that information has been incredibly helpful because we should now really appreciate the importance of the work that parents do. However, all of that information hasn't translated into more support and valuing of parenting. Mm. If anything, actually, parents are much less supported these days in terms of state support, healthcare support, community support. So parents are more often parenting in isolation. And then there's been such a growth of information, you know, in terms of social media, books, podcasts, articles. What I find in a lot of the people that I speak to nowadays is that they have their those kind of core parenting challenges that I mentioned earlier, but then they also have this added anxiety around how do I get this right? You know, how do I do this in the best possible way so that my child grows up happy and healthy? But actually the flip side of that for people is often the question of, have I broken them already? You know, have I already done irreparable damage and have I already messed up this whole parenting thing? And I think often, you know, that's because information is often presented in quite all or nothing ways. Increasingly, there are things like here are five top tips or things that you must never say to your children. And I think that often what people can find is that they feel quite paralysed by that in the end. You know, when we have so much information available to us, we go into a sort of freeze. It's very hard to choose what is the kind of information that is going to fit for me and my family in our unique set of circumstances.
Yeah, and it is so unique. That's the thing that I think is missing, as you said, from these top five tips or even, yeah, this idea that one thing is going to work for one child or for one family, when in reality we know as soon as you have maybe even one child or more, you know that that is just not the case. They're so different. And I thought it was very interesting when you talked about the parent-led parenting and the kind of books and reward charts and things and behavior and discipline. And I feel like, and my son's only, he's going to be 12 soon, so it's only 12 years that I've been a parent, but I feel like a lot of the conversation is almost pendulumed. We like to have extremes, don't we? It's like pendulum to all the way to the other extreme. So as you said, like things you must never say or never do. And I feel like some friends and some parents that I know are almost afraid now to say no or to have discipline or to have reward charts, or because as you said, it's like, am I going to mess up my child by giving them these things? But my somewhat maybe unpopular opinion is that we all need left and right limits, and that all children need, whether you call it rules, whether you call it guidelines, whether you call it boundaries, whatever word you choose to use, my experience with my nieces, my nephews, my cousins, my children, is that they need left and right limits. And even my ex-husband, who's a teacher, you know, he's been a teacher for 18 years, and this idea that we can't, you know, we've got to have a fear around telling a three-year-old no, or telling a four-year-old or a 10-year-old, like, this behavior is, this is, you know, behavior that I am not going to accept or tolerate, and this is why. I think it has almost become, yeah, parents are almost afraid, I think, now to do it wrong and to do anything and to, yeah, to be seen as being strict or being, you know, hard on them or punishing them because you're going to showcase that to them that you're, I don't know, you don't love them or that they've, you know, you're going to damage them forever. So how can we, I guess, yeah, how can we figure out that dance to say, actually, yes, if we agree they need left and right limits, but we don't want to, of course, yeah, go maybe back to this kind of like old school way. Yeah, how can people navigate that?
What's the balance, right? Where do we find the balance? And I think what you said there about the pendulum is really relevant, because you've mentioned earlier, you know, when we were talking about 80s and 90s high achievers, I think that often we've taken that high achievement and put it into our parenting. So we tend to be, you know, lots of the parents that I speak to tend to be quite research heavy. They'll go off and they'll research what is the kind of best way, in inverted commas, to parent a child, and what are the ways that I can parent this child that will have the best longer term outcomes for them. So we can almost go into parenting as a bit of a project, And we can also think about it as something that, you know, is a kind of success or failure experiment. Mm. And what we lose, or what we lose sight of when we think of it in that way, is that essentially we are testing ourselves. You know, we become part of an experiment that is all about our parenting strategies, techniques, what we say, what we do. And actually what we forget about is that where does that place our child? Our child then becomes our outcome.
Gosh, yeah.
So if they have a bad day, then our experiment is a failure. And, you know, it all becomes about doing, right? Like, how are we going to do this parenting thing? Where parenting is about a relationship. It's about how do we connect with another human being? And when we're so focused on doing, getting it right, doing it the right way, then actually it becomes much harder to just pause and connect with this human being who is in front of us.
Oh, it's so powerful when you say it that way, as in, yeah, parents expecting their child to be the outcome of their inputs. And that is,
yeah, and totally unconsciously, right? Totally unconsciously. And this is not something that people kind of consciously mean to do. But I think that a lot of the way that we talk about parenting almost sets it up in that way. So we end up feeling at the end of the day, was it a successful day? Because, you know, my child responded really well to my parenting intervention, rather than was that a successful day? Because actually I feel really good and we connected with each other and we had a laugh, you know, or that whatever that success might look like for you. I think that part of that is a kind of historical construct, or a historical, like you said, pendulum swing, because if in the 80s and 90s, the predominant parenting style was something that was quite authoritarian, so something that was more parent-led, you know, kind of going to put my foot down, children should be seen and not heard, all of those kind of messages that were much more prevalent in those days. What we know from attachment research is that the impact of that is more likely to be a kind of insecure attachment, so an avoidant or an anxious attachment. And what we then tend to do is that we do pendulum swing to the opposite. Mm-hmm. And eventually, you know, over generations, we end up getting somewhere that is probably secure. So generationally, you know, that pendulum swing will get shorter and shorter until, you know, we end up somewhere that feels kind of safe, comfortable and secure. But it feels like that is almost happening on a generational level. So if the majority of people feel like they were brought up in more of a kind of avoidant attachment, which is much more common in the UK in the 80s and 90s, people really don't want to replicate that feeling that they had when they were younger, knowing what it felt like to be shouted at or not to be listened to or to be sent to your room, not to be recognised as a person, which is kind of the consequence of that. Then we overcompensate by thinking, I am going to do everything in my power to make sure that this child feels heard, seen, understood, cared for, nurtured. And then, of course, where we fall into problems is in the overcompensation, is that what we then lose is those kind of boundaries, or, like you said, something to kind of push against at the end of that spectrum, which children do need. You know, children do need structure. We all need structure. We all need to know what's expected of us. It can be really reassuring. And for a lot of children, that, you know, there is then that kind of question of, well, you know, who's in charge then if nobody's telling me what is okay for me to do or not to do? It's something that I hear a lot from parents who've been really invested in, you know, kind of gentle parenting, that kind of very tuned in parenting that is much more popular. It's like a real massive TikTok trend at the moment, that actually what can feel really tricky, you know, nurture and care can feel easy, but setting boundaries as children become toddlers or as they grow up, you know, how do I get that balance right between saying no and asserting my own authority in my parenting relationship, but while still kind of honouring the needs and opinion of this child too? And that is where collaboration comes in, right? Because we can do that. That would be that kind of authoritative parenting that we are aspiring to often, which we know is kind of linked to that more secure attachment pattern. But it's a very hard balance to get right. And I think when we're so invested in learning, in doing parenting in particular ways, that can feel much more complicated than it actually is when we're focusing just on the relationship.
Yeah, and there's, I suppose what I'm thinking as well, even when you said gentle parenting, I know friends that would laugh. They would laugh out loud because we, you know, culture plays such a role as well, doesn't it? And yeah. so for some yeah. of my friends, whether they've got African parents, Jamaican parents, as much as they might joke about, you know, some of the strict rules around, you know, having to make your bed and having to cook dinner when you're like 10 years old, they yeah. also joke at the fact that this idea of gentle parenting, like my friend often says, you know, she's got African parents, lots of African friends, and she actually says, if you want to do gentle parenting, she's like, cool, I'm happy for you, do it in your own house. Because she's like, if you bring your kids to like a social event, and this idea of gentle parenting, like we said, I'm not saying that that's what it is, but the extreme of it is that, yeah, exactly, letting them be seen, letting them be heard, never really telling them no, never kind of letting, yeah, setting any kind of parameters around their behavior. And she jokes because she's like, I don't want to be around people who do gentle parenting because their kids just rule the everything. Right. And right. it's yeah, and I don't mean to diminish it or make a joke, but I think it is, yeah, there's so many things that influence, whether it is culture, whether it is even just the child themselves, their temperament. Yes, some children absolutely. Respond so differently absolutely. To the same thing that for some people they might do gentle parenting and their child is just an absolute breeze, absolute dream, easygoing. Like, I mean, I didn't do the gentle parenting thing, but my son, who's almost 12, he is the most laid back human, and he does not, you know, this thing again, people want to take pride or credit for their children. He's not for me at all. You know, I've always been outgoing. I've always been confident. I've always been competitive. I've always been, you know, naturally I would fall more into like leadership. He is the opposite of that in so many ways. He will never volunteer to lead. He's happy for others to lead. He is a diplomat. He's a negotiator. He is so laid back. You could literally say to my son, Jude, the house is on fire. And if he was reading a book, he'd look up and go, oh, okay, like as if, you know, what do you want me to do? Should I leave? Like, he's so chill. And again, he's so wonderful. But then it also, again, that has its challenges, you know, no sense of urgency in life, like has challenges. Yeah. But we laugh because, you know, we're so different and we really do laugh about it. You know, the other, I joke with him about when I was his age, you know, I could cook a roast dinner, I could do the washing, I could do all these things. I was so capable, you know, I had younger siblings. I used to change nappies, put them to bed. He literally the other day asked me if the milk was out of date, and I asked him to smell it to see, and he sniffed the plastic bottle, the actual bottle, the outside. And honestly, we just burst out laughing because I was like, Jude, what are you doing? Take off the lid and smell the milk. Like, it's that kind of thing where I'm thinking, I could cook a roast dinner at 12, and this boy, I'm just thinking, what is going to happen? But we have to laugh at the fact that he is exactly who he is. And of course, yeah. environment and, you know, I'm sure, you know, the books that we've read or the places that we've been to, there's some influence. However, I strongly believe that the core essence, like who the human being is so much of that is just who they are. And we just yeah. have to accept it, work with it, try to, I guess, enjoy it, bring out the best, whatever, but not kind of think, well, this is a result or an outcome of my inputs, because personally, in my experience, it hasn't been that at all.
And often I think we can get into that as parents, where we have that sudden realization, right, of this thing that I've been doing, or this kind of idea that I have of my child maybe wasn't true, because we see them as almost an extent, or we can see them as an extension of ourselves. But exactly like you say, you know, children come into the world, they are influenced by so many different things. You know, that might be their genes, it might be their womb environment, you know, it might also be their temperament. And there's lots in there about, you know, kind of genetic parts of temperament too. When we were talking earlier about parenting strategies and the kind of things that we might choose, or the way that we might choose to respond to our children, one of the concepts that I think is really useful to know about is just that idea of goodness of fit. So in temperament terms, you know, we know that people are kind of born with, they just show up in different ways, right? There are parts of our personality that are just always there. And we can either try and shift them or mold them in order to be able to fit into something that feels more acceptable, or they can be accepted as they are. And then, as exactly as you said, you know, we kind of allow that part to flourish or to thrive when we accept it and embrace it. Often where people can fall into difficulty is that we, you know, if we have a child who is very, very different to us, but we find that difficult to accept, then we can kind of come up against each other in friction. And when we are different, but we accept that difference, then again, that kind of goodness of fit is there. It's a bit easier. So we know how to get along with each other. We can also have a really easy fit where we're very temperamentally similar, And that is one part of parenting that we don't often talk about. You know, how easy do I find this baby or child? You know, how much do I understand them because I relate to them, or, you know, I just get who they are because actually lots of the things that they do remind me of who I am. Or like you're talking about, actually, this is a very different child, but I'm quite, you know, curious about these differences and obviously really accepting of those differences in the way that you've spoken about him. So we don't have to be the same, but we do need to understand who we both are in those relationships if we're going to be able to get along and not kind of bump up against each other with friction all the time.
Yeah, I really like that goodness of fit. That's fantastic. And, you know, I'd also like to say for any listeners, because I'm certainly not a perfect parent, if such a thing exists. And I think when you talked then about, you know, how it can be challenging when they're not the same as you, I think potentially maybe how that would come up for me is, as I said, I've always been competitive, and I've always been, not in the sense necessarily about like you have to be the best or you have to beat other people, but just competitive to kind of, you know, do the best that you can. So whether that's, you know, if that's a running race, it's a race, you're trying to come first, you know, it's because Judah's so laid back. I think it previously, if I'd, yeah, in sporting things or, you know, just anything where I'd be like, it doesn't matter about being the best, but you've got to give your best. But when someone's so laid back that they're kind of just like, yeah, you know, sure, whatever, it can be frustrating because you're thinking they're not going to fulfill their potential, or they're not going to, you know, and maybe that's okay. Maybe they're not bothered about their potential. So it's interesting again how, yeah, I think it's a constant journey of learning, and different ages will throw up different things. But something I'd love to hear about is some kind of hows, because this show, you know, I always want to give people like practical takeaways, things they can think about, things they can actually do. So the how is really important to me. And I read, I think it was in the press release about the book, I read a line that said, this book, your book, we need to talk all about the book and the title of the book and Parenting for Humans and why you wrote it. But this one line I really wanted to talk to you, it said, this book helps parents to find the things that make parenting a joy. Now, I circled and highlighted this word joy because joy is something that I prioritize in life and I think is something I want to talk to more people about. And so, as we've discussed, a lot of the parenting books that we might have seen before might talk about how to discipline, how to educate, how to prepare your kids to be adults and all these things, but they might not focus on how to enjoy parenting and how to allow your kids to enjoy being kids, because they're not adults right now. They will be one day, but right now they are kids. And I think this element of joyfulness, and not to say that it will always be easy or that there won't be, yeah, very difficult, challenging times or sleep deprived times or behavioral times, but the joy part, I think, is so often overlooked. And so often we kind of, yeah, whether we're focusing on academic results or whether we're focusing on behavior, it's just this idea that joy is just like, okay, that's saved for maybe birthdays or weekends. But I'd love to talk to you about why, as parents, we need to maybe focus more on joy, on enjoying parenting and allowing our kids to enjoy being themselves.
Yes. Oh, where do I begin? I think, first of all, you know, it goes back to what we were talking about before, that when we're focused on parenting as a kind of sign of achievement or success, it's really hard to make space for joy. Because it's all about the doing and it's not just about the being together. And that's where we find joy in each other, in all of our relationships, right? Like not just in our parenting relationships. It's those moments of connection where we're like, oh, we're together. And I feel like we're aligned and we're getting on and this is nice. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, look really joyful on the outside, but we can have that experience of joy and pleasure in our bodies because we feel connected to another human being. That's really what being human is all about, right? It's about connecting with other human beings. We are relational creatures. We love connecting with each other on our own terms and in our own ways, but absolutely connection is something that keeps us well and thriving. So I think the first thing would be just kind of finding ways to let go of that sense that it has to be about achievement or success or doing, and focusing much more on what are the things that we just enjoy. Like how do we enjoy being together? What are the things that we find pleasure in, that we shared, these shared experiences? And they don't have to be big. And I think this is one of those things that social media and our kind of social pressures can really get in the way of, because we might think of joy in parenting as being like a trip to Disneyland or an activity that we go out and do together. But actually, when you ask children about what they enjoy, it's going and looking at a leaf in a park for as long as they are allowed to. You know, actually having the permission to just take the world at their pace. It might be sitting having a hot chocolate and watching a film together. You know, it's these often very small moments of connection that we can really overlook as parents because they don't meet our expectations of what good parenting looks like. I think also there is something about really understanding children, which is what you talked about, because one of the things that I talk about a lot in my work and also in the book is this idea that we can't really enjoy our parenting until we understand ourselves. And in some ways, the reason for that is because if we don't understand ourselves, we can often tend to look at our children through the lens of our own experience. So when they are doing something, we're relating it to our experience rather than really being able to see what it is and how it's affecting them. It means that there's a kind of disconnect that can be there all the time because we're seeing them through our eyes rather than really hearing about their own experience. And part of a child's experience, particularly at the moment, is growing up in a very unfriendly world, a world that is very unfriendly to children and families, and the impact of that on them. And I think that we're really seeing the impact on children of the stress of the last few years with the pandemic, with families being under so much pressure. You know, there are lots of children at the moment who are saying, actually, this has been really hard for me, and they're showing it in various different ways, you know, kind of either more internally as anxiety or externally as what might look like challenging behaviour. Children do have this natural spark. You know, they come so vibrant into the world and they are so curious and so magical. You know, children in themselves are such magical creatures. The way that they think, their imaginations, the way that they see the world. And what we tend to do in our society and culture is that very early on, we start to kind of mould them to fit our expectations of what children should be. And you said something earlier on about them almost being like little adults. If we're able to tune into what really is a magical way of thinking, it can bring us so much joy too, but it's really not in keeping with what other people might expect from us as grown-ups. So it's really interesting what you said at the beginning, right, about how you really enjoy playing. Lots of adults find play so difficult. But when we're able to get over our kind of self-consciousness, and it might not be play, you know, kind of traditionally what we might see as play, it might be leading a child in something that feels playful to you or just tuning into what they want to do. But connecting with them on that kind of imagination level can really also allow us to experience pleasure in entering their world and not always bringing them into our world.
Well, that would be exactly what I was thinking when you said that about people find play difficult. And I think that comes when they want to lead, as you said. So I've got to come up with an idea, or I've got to come up with a game, or I've got to engage the children and entertain them, when actually, I think it's the other way around for me. I think if you are curious and you just ask them questions, if you ask a child a question, every single child is going to give you a different answer. And then you just ask them another question and another question. And before you let them lead, actually, like allow them to lead. And I feel like that's when you go into their world and they want to spend more time with you. They want to be around you. You know, they want to, because it's someone who's going into their world, who's interested in whatever it is they're talking about, whether they're telling you, like you said, about, you know, the leaves that they're trying to make into a potion, or whether it's about, I don't know, a pretend game because they're telling you about this character from a book, or if it's just things that you might not enjoy at all. I've talked about this before. My son is really into WWE wrestling right now. Mm-hmm. Now I can tell you, of all the phases and stages that he's been interested in, whether it was dinosaurs, whether it was space, whether it was football, Star Wars, I could kind of get on board with most of them. WWE wrestling does not interest me at all. And when you said about the small moments of connection, we can have a weekend where I might think, oh yeah, we've done all these great things. Maybe we've been to a museum in London. We've been to a restaurant. We've done all these things. And I can literally say to Jude at the end of the weekend, what did you enjoy most about this weekend, or what you're looking forward to, or whatever? And his answer is typically like, oh, it was really great when we sat and read that WWE comic, or yeah. You know, and something that we did together. But it's his world, it's WWE, and He's telling me about, you know, this WrestleMania and this champion that's come back, and I'm literally like, and I go for it, you know, I don't love it, I'm not gonna lie and say like, oh, I can't wait to watch SmackDown highlights. I don't want to do it, but I do it anyway, because if that's 20 minutes or if it's 30 minutes or if it's whatever, that is time in his world. So whatever that is for you, for your child, whatever age and stage, if you find play difficult, don't think about it as play, but just think about, what are they into? Is it dinosaurs? Is it space? Is it, I don't know, drawing? Is it music? And just ask some questions and just go into their world and spend a bit of time there. And yeah, just if you can, even if it's 5 minutes, you'll see it's so different to when you're saying, I really want us to do this puzzle together, or let's go outside and play football and do something that's activity. Because often it's things we want them to do, and they might not be interested in those things at all.
And also, you know, it is about curiosity, right? Because what you're talking about there is actually, this is something that does not have any, you know, does not light my fire one bit, but actually seeing it lighting his fire, you know, kind of like being able to see his joy in it is what it offers him. You know, so you don't have to be interested. You can even say like, this is really not my bag, but I'm interested in hearing about why you find it so interesting. Because actually that's kind of, that's really what we build our relationships on, right? It's those shared connections. And we know what that feels like as adults when somebody is really interested in what we've got to say. You know, if I talk to you about psychology, right, obviously that's something that I'm very interested in, and you were then to ask me loads of questions, you know, that it really sparks that kind of, shared curiosity, shared interest, but also that feeling of, oh, you know, you're actually interested in what I've got to say. You know, you kind of really want to hear from me. That might make me feel cared for, right? It's not necessarily about acts of care. It's also just curiosity and having that kind of shared interest in something. And I think, you know, what can really get in the way, especially as parents or adults generally, when we're talking to children, is that it goes against all of our stories about what it is to be a good, sensible adult. So you have to come up against that part of you that might feel really self-conscious, because actually maybe there is a bit of you that can really tune into how you felt as a child, that maybe is very curious about play, is quite happy to get down on the floor and get mucky, for example, and, you know, get into a leaf pile or whatever it might be. But then there's also that kind of grown-up part of you going, oh, but what are other people going to think? Or what if I kind of get this wrong? Or, you know, actually, I'm going to make my clothes really mucky, or whatever it might be. You know, these kind of stories or narratives or expectations that can get in the way of connecting, not just with our children, but with other people too. You know, that shows up for people all the time, that, you know, that kind of longing within us to connect on a human to human level. But then we can put lots of barriers or obstacles in the way, because it might not fit with what we feel people are expecting of us, or our kind of internalized expectations that we've grown up with, even if there's nobody else actually around.
I think all of those things, of course, are really true. And I think one more thing to add maybe to that as well, if I think about some of my parenting friends and the conversations we've had over the years, is that also there's so much to do as a parent. So sometimes my friends will say to me, you know what, it's not that I don't want to play, or I don't want to watch the Star Wars, or I don't want to go in the garden and get messy. It's not that, but they're just like, you know what, I'm so overwhelmed with so much to do, because I have a full-time job, and I have to, you know, wash the football kit, and I've got to feed the dog, and I've got to do all these other things. Actually, play comes so far down on the list. And they almost like, feel guilty about that, or berate themselves, because they're like, oh, you know what, actually, I don't know the last time I sat and read for an hour with my kids, because I'm too busy, I've got all this other stuff to do. So yeah, I think it's also important for parents to acknowledge that maybe the modern world, maybe their lifestyle, maybe whatever reason it is, you know, maybe solo parents, there's so many things that you have to do as a human being and a parent. And I think that can be quite I think for people to kind of remember that as well, so they don't feel so much guilt if they're not, you know, building a fort every night out of sheets, because let's be honest, definitely, like often there's all those other things to do.
Yes, but again, there is a kind of expectation there, right, that can creep in about what it would look like to be connected to a child and, you know, kind of spending an hour building a fort every night. Because it can just be moments, right? It can literally just be moments of connection, just being curious and being, you know, kind of interested in each other. And, you know, absolutely what you say is so true, because I think that we talked about the context, you know, of the last 20 years. One of the things that's changed massively since we were children ourselves, certainly since our grandparents had children, is that it is much more common now for both parents, if there are two parents in the home, both parents to be working. It's much more common for people to be raising children on their own. It's also very expensive to raise children, and there's very little family and community support around that. So all of that pressure on us as adults can obviously cause huge obstacles, not just in our ability to be present with children, but also our stress. People are very stressed, and stress obviously gets in the way of us connecting with all of our relationships with other people, because we are in that very doing state. You know, we end up in survival mode. We're kind of just thinking, we're often on autopilot, right? What do I need to do next in order to be able to get through this day? Yeah. One of the things that I think, you know, you talked about being a difference in your own childhood, is that we can also bring our children in to do some of those jobs with us. We might not do that when we're in quite a stressed out state, because it can feel like it's going to take a lot longer and we just want to get through it quickly because there's so much to do.
Oh, I'll be honest with you. I'll be honest with you. Mine was due to necessity. I feel like, you know, my mum was solo. She was a single parent. She was definitely stressed and tired and did not have the capacity for, I guess, these moments of connection and joy and play and reading. There was no time for that because she was a single parent in a low income, salary with four kids. So mine came out of necessity, because it was like, right, these jobs have got to be done. You've got to cook the dinner. The washing needs to be done. Yeah. You know, your brother needs to go to bed. So I definitely took on, I think, probably a more parental role because I had to. But I agree, I think bringing kids in to say, you know what, there's all these things that need to be done, and it's not always fun. Like, I try and do that now, it's not always fun to have to clean out the guinea pig cage or wash the car or do the laundry. But I think bringing them in to see actually the work that you're doing, like, it is work, isn't it? Like the household things, like, it's work. I think bringing them into that and saying, actually, these things have to be done, so come and help.
Yes, and that is life too, right? And I think you said something earlier about we can often see the kind of connection or fun that we have with our children as being something that happens at the weekends or on holidays, but this is life. You know, we are living life with them 24/7. So how do we also allow them to come into our world, and how do we invite them in a way that often those are the times that we can have the best conversations with our kids, especially kids of your age, where you're side by side, you know, chopping vegetables together, or you're putting a wash on together, or you're hanging up laundry together. That's where you can get into that kind of slightly free flowing, let's just have a chat about what's on our minds without any pressure to do that. So it isn't.
And then they will moan. They will complain. I was going to say that, I feel that's where I go into like of course cliche lecturing mother. But I had to take my son in the other day to the supermarket. He said, "Oh, can I wait in the car?" And I said, "No, you can come. You can help. You know, like, because I want him to sit in." It's like, it takes effort and energy to go and buy the food, pack up the bags, carry them to the car. I was like, "You can help." And you kind of think, you know, the way you're describing it now is like these moments of sharing. I don't know. You're like chopping the vegetable. Like, it's going to be fun. It's not going to be fun. They're going to moan and they're going to complain. But I think just doing it anyway. I hope that maybe there's a bit of a lesson in there. You know, around, I don't know, contribution and work ethic.
Yes. And how do we resolve those conflicts, right? Without, you know, it having to become a really big conversation, but how do we resolve a conflict where we have different needs or different wishes? And actually, I complain in my own head when I've got to do something that I don't really want to do. But, you know, we then have that internalized voice of, you know, we find ways to make it feel bearable, or we'll find ways to make it feel something that we can do. And actually, so much of what we're doing as parents is giving our children those messages that they are then going to internalize in their adult life. So yes, it's hard, but we can do it together. Or I know it's boring, but let's crack on and we can have a chat while we're doing it, whatever it might be. You know, something that allows the difficult or the struggle to be there, but we can still do it. And, you know, and we're gonna do that together. Because those are all of the voices that, you know, we use ourselves as adults that can tell us to kind of get on with something, or that we can do something even when it feels hard or boring or difficult. Yeah. Actually, what's difficult is that when those voices are kind of critical, then that can be that, you know, we're doing it out of a fear of criticism. One of those things that we can think about when we are trying to encourage our children to do things that they might not want to do is how do we want them to be speaking to themselves as they grow up? So it might be, you know, firmness plus encouragement, for example.
Mm. Yeah, I love this. Oh, this is fascinating. Honestly, I feel like we're going to have to do a part two, and maybe especially when we get into the teenage years. Oh my gosh, we're going to have to do definitely another episode all about that.
All of the story.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Yeah, but for today, as we don't sadly have much more time, and I really want to talk to you about the power hour, which is the first hour of every day. Now, Emma, I know that you're a parent, you have two children, and so for a lot of parents, when they hear the concept of the power hour, they're just like, is she kidding? A whole hour every morning for myself? And it doesn't have to be, you know, an hour that is dedicated to exercise or reading or meditation. Like, if you want to do those things and you are able to do those things, then of course, great. I'd love to hear what you do typically in the first hour of your day.
So I am a very early riser, I think, because my children are a bit older now, and you kind of get trained, don't you, to wake up very early when they're tiny. I had one of my children was a very, very early riser, so we used to be up at 5 every day. And I kind of kept that going, so I tend to get up very early, 5 or 6 every day. I do go to bed early too. And I just often, depending on how busy I've been, sometimes I don't do anything at all. It's just about having a quiet home. So occasionally I do use meditation, I do journal, but I think that when you've got very little children, those things can feel, like you said, so hard to access. Actually, I think for parents, often what they really need is just space and quiet. So for me, it's about having some of that space around that time where I feel like the house is still and I can just be on my own with my thoughts. And then I can do whatever I want to do with that time. So maybe I might do a bit of work and sometimes do a bit of exercise, but it's just knowing that I do have that space to myself at the beginning of the day. I'm going to add to that, that it took me a very long time to get there. And there was a very long time where I would wake up early, the house would be sleeping, and then I'd just hear this like little pitter patter of feet. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, I'm going to have company for this hour. But what I've kind of learned to do, I think one of the words that is really helpful for parents to hear is that sometimes you just need to surrender, you know, surrender to this is in this moment, this is a need that my child has. I'm not going to have my idealized hour that I really wanted for myself, but how can I bring that into this hour that I have with my child? So that would still be an hour of stillness, quiet, as calm as possible, not always easy when they're toddlers or babies, but something where, you know, there wasn't much distraction around. It was just about a slow start to the day.
Mm, yeah, I really like that. And actually just the point you made there around not necessarily saying, well, because the child's awake, all the things that I wanted to do or plan to do, scrap it and it's over to them. Because as you said, it can be a blend of bringing them into that and letting them know the expectation in that first hour, as you said, might be that actually you have to whisper, you have to use a quiet voice, other people in the house might still be sleeping. That's something that we talk about in the weekends with my stepchildren and my stepson, because he's youngest, is, yeah, other people might be sleeping, his sister's sleeping, so you have to use a quiet voice. You have to, and it's not the case that just because you're up, you can, yeah, get all your toys out, you can run around, like, you have to wait. And I think that's also, yeah, again, it's a balance. Some people might laugh at that and be like, oh my gosh, try telling my 3-year-old to use a quiet voice. But if you, I guess, yeah, I don't know, try and show them that sometimes it's all about them, sometimes it's not.
Yes, and it's what we're modelling right then, because even if they're not using a quiet voice themselves, over time, if we carry on doing that, and I think this is one of those things that can be so hard about parenting, right? Because we might say the same thing 20,000 times.
Yes.
At some point it sticks. At some point it sticks. And, you know, that might be that a child is not yet able to to do a quiet voice. You know, they're not able to kind of control their impulses enough to be able to talk softly. At some point they will shift, they will develop, and then they are, you know, it is more possible for them. So I think just those kind of repeated things, rituals that can feel so important in families that might look different day to day, but if you know what you're aiming for and something that feels very simple, very achievable, then that's something that can feel more and more, it can become more achievable as your kids get older.
Well, fascinating stuff. As I said, I knew it was going to be wonderful, and I've really, really enjoyed talking to you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you so much for having me. It was so lovely to hear about your own experiences as well.
And the book, Parenting for Humans, is, of course, out now. So, yeah, where can we get the book?
You can get it from all usual bookshops. So if you have a look on Mammologist on Instagram, I've got all of the links to buy it in my bio.
Fab. We'll also put links in the show notes as well. So again, thank you so much. Thanks everyone for tuning in and for listening. As always, I appreciate it. If you've enjoyed this episode, if you know someone who would definitely get value from hearing this conversation, then please do share it with them. And I'll be back next week with another episode. See ya.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.